Hello, welcome back to Behind the Scams.
Yes, welcome back.
Today, we are diving into a really incredible topic. The title of our deep dive today is The Romance Scam That Turned a Community Leader into an International Prisoner.
It is such a heavy one.
It really is. And our mission for this deep dive is to basically explore the psychological machinery of modern fraud. We've got a massive stack of source materials today, like international crime reports and, you know, these really harrowing victim testimonies.
Yeah, the source materials for this are just extensive.
Right. And I want to say directly to you listening, you might think you could never fall for a scam, but today we are going to show you exactly how these invisible traps are laid.
Yes, welcome back. Today's deep dive is about one of the most unique and devastating true scam stories, the case of Donna Nelson, a 58-year-old Australian Indigenous community leader, mother of five, and former political candidate.
And I really want to pause right there on her background for a second. Because when we hear the word, you know, scam victim, our minds just kind of default to this very specific, honestly, almost insulting stereotype.
Right, like someone who isn't tech savvy.
Exactly. We picture someone deeply naive, maybe elderly, totally disconnected from the modern world, just, you know, clicking on a blinking pop-up ad that says they want a cruise.
Which does happen, but that is not this story.
Not at all. Donna Nelson shatters that preconception entirely. I mean, this is a highly respected Yaqui woman. She actually ran for office with the Western Australian Greens Party.
She was a serious public figure.
Yeah, she was the CEO of the Pioneers Aboriginal Corporation. Her entire professional life was literally dedicated to sharp strategic thinking and protecting vulnerable people, specifically disadvantaged youth.
She spent her life advocating for others.
Right. Her daughters described her as the kind of woman who would literally bring her child protection work home, like giving them a temporary sibling because she just cared so deeply. She was, you know, an absolute powerhouse.
Which really forces us to look at the mechanics of deception through a completely different lens. Because if a powerhouse community leader can be dismantled and manipulated into becoming an international drug smuggler.
It's just wild to even say that out loud.
It is. But it means the methods being used are not clumsy, they are surgical. When we analyze the criminology behind these modern syndicates in our sources, we see a heavy reliance on a concept called the mosaic effect.
The mosaic effect. Okay, let's unpack this. What exactly does that look like?
So, scammers are essentially building psychological profiles. They scrape public records, social media, professional bios, charity affiliations, all to find a very specific vulnerability.
Like putting together pieces of a puzzle.
Exactly. In Donna's case, she was this fiercely busy professional who spent all her energy caring for others. But, and this is the crucial piece of the mosaic, she had not been in a romantic relationship for nearly 20 years.
Okay, let's unpack this because I need to push back on the logistics of that a little bit. I mean, it's sort of like a perfect storm, right? But I understand how a targeted ad might figure out I want to buy a new pair of shoes based on my search history.
Sure, the algorithm knows what you click on.
Right, but how on earth does a criminal sitting thousands of miles away in a completely different hemisphere identify that a specific CEO in Western Australia is feeling lonely? I mean, how do they pinpoint these specific emotional vulnerabilities across the globe? It sounds like you're describing an intelligence agency, not some scammer on a laptop.
Well, it sounds like an intelligence agency because structurally speaking, that is exactly what these syndicates are. They don't operate like lone wolves anymore.
They don't.
No, they operate like industrialized corporate entities. They purchase massively enriched data lists right off the dark web. They deploy algorithms that scan platforms like Facebook or LinkedIn for very specific keywords.
What kind of keywords?
Terms indicating widowhood, divorce, or even just a long-term focus purely on career and family. They map out geographic regions with high disposable income. They are actively hunting for the paradox of the isolated leader.
Wow. The paradox of the isolated leader, meaning someone who has it all together financially but is alone.
Exactly. Someone entirely financially secure and highly capable but completely starved of romantic intimacy.
Yeah.
That specific combination makes the target a perfect candidate for the long game.
The long game. Let's really get into what that means in Donna's case because the details are just terrifying. So The person who targeted her went by the name Kelly.
Right, Kelly.
And Kelly didn't just spend like a few weeks sending her heart emojis before asking for iTunes gift cards. This individual or group or whoever spent 2 entire years building trust with her.
24 months.
2 years. I mean, that's daily messages, good morning texts, asking about her day, listening to her stress about her job as a CEO. That requires a level of patience that almost feels completely counterintuitive to a criminal enterprise. You know, you'd think they'd want a quick payout and to move on to the next mark.
You would think so, but the quick payout model is actually becoming obsolete in the upper echelons of transnational fraud. Yeah. The tactic Kelly used relies on a psychological mechanism called fabricated rapport.
Fabricated rapport. So basically, faking a deep connection.
Yes, and it takes time to alter someone's baseline reality. The scammers study the victim's digital footprint to engage in mirroring. So say Donna posted about a really stressful day at the Aboriginal Corporation.
Right, she vents online.
Exactly. Kelly would immediately express deep empathy and perhaps share a fabricated story about his own stressful day managing employees. It creates this artificial, highly accelerated sense of intimacy.
It's like they're reflecting back the exact person she wants to talk to.
Precisely. And in the global fraud ecosystem, which is heavily documented in the recent Chi analysis and global fraud reports we reviewed, this entire slow drip manipulation is referred to as pig butchering.
Pig butchering? I mean, that phrase is just incredibly visceral. It implies something so systematic, cold, and, you know, ultimately fatal.
It's awful, isn't it? It's actually a direct translation of a Chinese term, shazupan, which is used internally by the syndicates themselves.
They actually call it that.
Yes. The concept is that you don't just steal from the victim right away, you fatten the pig. You feed it with constant attention, manufactured affection, and sometimes even small financial returns to build absolute unquestioning trust.
So you're making them feel safe and rewarded.
Exactly. You ensure the victim is entirely emotionally dependent on the relationship. Only when the victim is maximally invested, both psychologically and financially, do you execute the slaughter.
The slaughter, meaning they just take everything.
Right. The total extraction of their assets, or in Donna's case, their utility.
Wow. So for 2 years, Kelly is fattening this emotional bond. And here's where it gets really interesting. The persona Kelly used to do this. He presented himself to Donna as a Nigerian fashion businessman who is currently based in Japan.
A very specific backstory.
Super specific. I mean, why choose that exact combination of nationality and location? It seems almost random.
It might seem random, but it's highly deliberate. It fits a psychological framework we call the unavailable professional.
The unavailable professional. Okay, I'm tracking.
If you look through the victim testimonies in our sources, you see the exact same archetypes repeated over and over. The oil rig engineer working out in the North Sea. The military surgeon deployed to a classified base in Afghanistan. The international importer-exporter.
People who have legitimate reasons to be hard to reach.
Exactly. Or, in one truly bizarre case documented in the Japan police reports, a man claiming to be a Russian astronaut trapped on the International Space Station.
Wait, really? A Russian astronaut?
Yes. He claimed he needed his victim to wire him money for a return rocket back to Earth.
I mean, my instinct is to just laugh because that sounds like a movie plot, but clearly it worked on someone. Does the absurdity actually serve a purpose? Like, are they intentionally making the story outlandish to filter out skeptical people?
That is absolutely part of it. It's a self-selecting mechanism. If you believe the astronaut's story, you are already demonstrating a very high level of compliance. But more importantly, the unavailable professional persona provides a bulletproof excuse.
An excuse for what, exactly?
For the physical barriers in the relationship. It explains away the strange time zone differences. It explains why they might have weird banking irregularities and need financial favors. And crucially, it provides an airtight reason for why they absolutely cannot get on a live video call.
Right, because the second you jump on FaceTime, the entire illusion shatters.
Precisely.
So Kelly says, you know, I'm a busy fashion businessman in Tokyo. I'm constantly traveling. The Wi-Fi in my manufacturing warehouses is terrible. It perfectly insulates him from Donna's natural desire to actually see the man she is falling in love with.
It creates a plausible wall between them.
Exactly. And it also seeds Japan in her mind as this romantic destination where they will eventually build a life together. But if Kelly isn't actually a fashion businessman in Japan, who is Donna actually talking to every single morning?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, The reality of the person on the other end of the keyboard is just staggering.
Yeah.
Based on recent United Nations reports and unsealed Department of Justice indictments we looked at, Donna was likely interacting with a vertically integrated fraud factory.
A fraud factory?
Yes. Based heavily in the Mekong region of Southeast Asia, in areas within Cambodia, Laos, or Myanmar.
When you say vertically integrated, you're using a business term. You mean like a tech company where everything from engineering to marketing is handled in-house, like under one roof.
Exactly like that. We are talking about syndicates that operate out of massive fortified compounds. Some are even disguised as casinos or special economic zones.
Disguised as casinos, that's insane.
It is. The DOJ recently indicted the chairman of the Prince Group, which exposed an operation that generated an estimated $64 billion annually. So Kelly was almost certainly not a single person.
That completely changes the mental image. I think most of us picture like one guy in a hoodie in a basement.
Not at all. Kelly is an entire department. Donna was likely speaking to a team of operators working in rotating shifts, sitting in a room filled with hundreds of other scammers.
So they just pass her file back and forth.
Yes. They use shared psychological scripts drafted by actual behavioral experts. They have a human resources department to manage the operators. They have a money laundering division to handle the crypto transactions. It is a multi-billion dollar corporate entity designed from the ground up to hack human empathy.
Wow. So Donna is essentially in a two-year emotional relationship with the corporation.
Basically, yes.
And then comes the pivot. The moment the corporation decides it is time for the slaughter. After 24 months of promises, Kelly tells Donna he wants to finally meet in person. And he doesn't just ask her to come to Japan, he buys her first-class ticket.
Which is an absolute masterclass in psychological manipulation. We can classify this as the first-class ticket trap.
It completely flips the script on what we expect a scammer to do. I mean, the conventional wisdom is that a scammer is going to ask you to wire them $1,000 for a flight. But by spending thousands of dollars on a luxury ticket for Donna, Kelly provides the ultimate tangible proof that he is real.
And that he is wealthy.
Right. In Donna's mind, a fraudster wouldn't spend that kind of money on her. It just doesn't compute.
It also triggers a deep psychological reflex known as the rule of reciprocity. By providing her with this extravagant gift, you know, a first-class flight, he creates an unspoken social debt.
So she feels like she owes him something.
Exactly. Okay. Donna feels overwhelmingly cherished, but also subtly obligated. So when the flight itinerary includes a seemingly innocuous stopover in Laos, she doesn't question it.
And Laos, as you just mentioned, is exactly where these massive scam compounds are located. That geographic detail is just chilling.
It really is.
So Donna is sitting in a hotel in Laos, waiting for her connecting flight to Tokyo. She's probably exhausted from the travel, but exhilarated because she thinks she is just hours away from embracing her future husband. Then Kelly calls her.
And he asks for a favor.
A tiny favor. He tells her a business associate is going to drop off a suitcase at her hotel. It just contains some clothing samples for his fashion business. All she needs to do is check this extra piece of luggage on her flight to Japan.
This is the critical transition point. The syndicate is moving Donna from a financial target to what law enforcement terms an unwitting mule.
An unwitting mule. Because she doesn't know what she's carrying.
Exactly. They are leveraging her immaculate profile. She is a 58-year-old grandmother, a respected community leader with a completely clean criminal record. To a customs border agent, she is essentially invisible.
She doesn't fit any profile of a drug smuggler.
Right. She is the perfect vessel to smuggle illicit goods across a heavily monitored international border.
She takes the suitcase. She doesn't see a drug cartel. She just sees her partner asking for help with his business, so she checks the bag. And then we arrive at the crisis point. It's December 2022. Donna Nelson lands at Narita International Airport outside Tokyo.
The moment everything changes.
She walks up to the customs counter, the officials pull her aside, decide to search her bags, and beneath a false bottom in that suitcase she was given in Laos, they find 2 kilograms of methamphetamine.
In a fraction of a second, that 2-year romantic fantasy is violently shattered, and she is thrust into the machinery of one of the most draconian legal systems on the planet.
I really want to dig into the legal reality here because, to anyone listening, the defense seems obvious, right? You pull out her phone, you show the Japanese authorities the thousands of messages, the fake persona, the 2 years of manipulation. It is entirely documented that she was a victim of a sophisticated psychological operation.
The evidence was all right there on her device.
And the truly maddening part of this story is that the Japanese court did look at the evidence. The presiding judge, Masakazu Kamakura, stated openly from the bench that he acknowledged Donna was deceived by a romance scam and that she only carried the bag because she had hopes of marriage.
He admitted it on the record.
Yes, they saw the truth. And then they sentenced her to 6 years in prison anyway. How does that happen? So what does this all mean for the victim's family, and how does the justice system fail them?
To understand that failure, we have to look at the foundational philosophy of the Japanese legal system, which operates very differently from Western models. Japan has a criminal conviction rate of over 99%.
99%? I mean, that doesn't even sound like a justice system. That sounds like a rubber stamp. Why is it so incredibly high?
It stems largely from their heavy reliance on confessions and a system known as Daiokungoku, or substitute prisons. This system allows suspects to be held and interrogated for up to 23 days without formal charges.
23 days without being charged?
Yes, and often without a lawyer present during questioning. But specifically in Donna's case, it really comes down to the legal doctrine of strict liability regarding narcotics. Japan's drug laws are notoriously unforgiving.
So they don't care about the context.
Exactly. The prosecution's argument was essentially this. Regardless of the emotional manipulation, she was an adult who accepted a mysterious suitcase from a stranger in a foreign country. Under their interpretation of the law, she exhibited willful blindness.
Willful blindness. So their argument is that she should have known better, but that completely ignores the biochemistry of what Kelly did to her brain over 2 years.
It does. Furthermore, the defense highlighted a massive procedural failure. During her initial interrogations at the airport, there was a severe lack of competent English language interpreters.
Oh, so she couldn't even properly defend herself in the moment.
Right, mistranslations occurred. The customs officials documented her initial shock and confusion in a way that painted her as being aware of the contraband. And once that initial report is filed in the Japanese system, overcoming it in court is nearly impossible, even when a judge sympathizes with the context of the scam.
The collateral damage is just sickening. Let's talk about the toll this takes on the victim's family. Donna has five daughters: Crystal, Ashley, Janelle, Taylor, and Shantai. Imagine knowing your mother, who spent her life advocating for your community, is suddenly locked in a foreign cell facing drug trafficking charges.
It's a nightmare for them.
For nearly 2 years while awaiting trial, her daughters couldn't even speak to her.
Because the conditions of her pre-trial detention were essentially psychological torture. According to her legal team, Donna was placed in solitary confinement. She was locked in a tiny cell for 23 and a half hours a day.
That is just brutal.
The rules of the detention center actually forbade her from speaking loudly, from singing, or even communicating with other detainees.
She actually told her lawyer she almost forgot how to speak.
Which is heartbreaking when you take an incredibly social, highly active community leader and subject her to extreme sensory deprivation and isolation while simultaneously forcing her to process the profound betrayal of a 2-year romance. The psychological decay is rapid. She reportedly became suicidal.
Meanwhile, her daughters are on the outside moving mountains. They are relentlessly fundraising to pay exorbitant international legal fees. They are traveling back and forth to Japan. They are petitioning for an international prisoner transfer just to get her back on Australian soil.
They've been fighting so hard.
They actually issued a public statement saying they are doing the investigative work themselves to track down the syndicate behind Kelly. And why are they doing it? Because neither the Australian nor the Japanese police are actively pursuing the scammers overseas.
They're just left to deal with the fallout alone.
Exactly. The justice system successfully locked up the unwitting weapon and completely ignored the hand that pulled the trigger.
It is a massive failure of international jurisdiction. And tragically, when we examine the wider victimology across our source materials, we realize Donna's devastation is just part of a much broader spectrum of ruin. The psychological override these syndicates achieve frequently leads to outcomes that are far worse than just financial ruin.
Right. Let's look at how the coercion continues even when the initial scam falls apart. There's the case of Laura Qual in the United States. She was a 57-year-old retired healthcare executive.
So a very similar demographic to Donna.
Very similar. A successful professional, widowed, looking for companionship online. She met a man claiming to be Frank, a Swedish businessman.
The classic unavailable professional archetype again.
Exactly. Frank manipulated her into investing $1.5 million into a fraudulent platform called Goose Investments. But the syndicate didn't stop when her money was gone. They pivoted.
They always want more.
They used the emotional leverage and the sunk cost fallacy to turn Laura into a money mule. They convinced her to open multiple bank accounts in her name to launder stolen funds for the syndicate.
The transition from victim to accomplice relies so heavily on shame. Once a victim realizes they have lost their life savings, the psychological shock is paralyzing. The scammers then offer a lifeline. They say, you know, we can fix this, we can get your money back, but you have to help us move these funds first.
And the victim is just desperate to fix it.
Right. The victim, desperate to undo the reality of the scam, just complies.
Until they realize the hole they are digging is actually a grave. Laura finally understood the reality of what she was doing. She left a note for her daughter that read, "I've been living a double life. I tried to stop this, but I knew I would end up dead." Days later, authorities found her body floating in the Mississippi River.
It's horrific.
Yeah.
It underscores that the violence of a digital scam is not abstract. It has physical, lethal consequences. We see a similar exploitation of vulnerability in non-romance scams, too.
Yeah, let's talk about Manny.
Right, and consider the case of Manny Guerrero.
Yeah.
He's a 90-year-old U.S. Air Force veteran. After his wife of 62 years passed away, he was profoundly lonely. He spent his time playing online games, which is exactly where a syndicate intercepted him with a sweepstakes scam.
They convinced a grieving 90-year-old man that he had won a $7.5 million prize, but he needed to continuously pay, like taxes and fees, to release the funds.
Classic fee fraud.
They drained him of $180,000. But the detail in this case that absolutely turns my stomach is what happened when Manny finally realized it was a fraud. He demanded his money back, and shockingly, the scammers mailed him physical checks.
But those checks were completely fraudulent.
Oh, they were worse than fraudulent. When the FBI traced the routing numbers on the checks Manny received, they discovered the accounts belonged to another elderly couple who were suffering from severe dementia.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The syndicate wasn't just stealing. They were using Manny to launder money stolen from dementia patients. They recycle the stolen funds between victims to confuse law enforcement.
It just demonstrates the absolute absence of morality in the syndicate model. Mm. They view victims purely as nodes in a financial network. But the true devastation, the reason these crimes are so rarely prosecuted, is the weaponization of the victim's own psychology against themselves.
You mean the shame of it all?
Specifically, the deployment of shame. A recent comprehensive report on the state of scams in Japan revealed a staggering statistic. 87% of fraud in the country goes completely unreported.
87%. That means the official numbers, like the $2.1 billion lost to scams in Japan last year, are just a tiny, tiny fraction of the reality. Why is that number so incredibly high? Is it really just embarrassment?
It is much deeper than mere embarrassment. In Japanese culture, there's a profound sociological concept of haji, which translates to deep societal shame or disgrace.
Haji.
Yes. The report highlighted the case of a woman named Aiko Ando. She was scammed out of 30 million yen. But it wasn't the loss of the money that ended her life. It was the secondary victimization by her own community.
What happened?
When her family discovered she had been deceived, they felt such intense haji, such a stain on their family's honor, that they entirely abandoned her. She died in total social isolation.
My God. So the scammers don't even need to threaten their victims into silence. The cultural infrastructure does it for them. The shame creates an invisible prison.
Exactly. But we also need to address the fact that not all of these operators remain digital ghosts. As our sources reveal, there's a terrifying subset of scammers who are escalating into direct physical violence.
Right. We absolutely need to talk about Aurora Phelps. The FBI literally referred to her operation as a romance scam on steroids.
Which is a chilling description.
It is. Phelps operated out of Las Vegas in Mexico, and she represents the absolute lethal extreme of this crime. She wasn't sitting behind a keyboard in a fortified compound in Laos. She was hunting in person.
Phelps utilized dating platforms like Tinder and OkCupid. She would target older, affluent men. She would establish a brief digital rapport, just enough to create intrigue, and then she would rapidly escalate to in-person meetings. She often arranged dates at their private homes or luxury hotel suites. She weaponized physical intimacy.
And when she was inside their homes, she drugged them.
Systematically. Her modus operandi involved surreptitiously slipping heavy, dangerous sedatives into their drinks or food during the date. The sources specifically point to the use of substances like scopolamine in these types of physical scams.
I've heard of scopolamine referred to as devil's breath.
Yes, that's the street name. It's heavily linked to South American criminal networks.
Explain biologically what this drug does, because it doesn't just put you to sleep like a normal sedative, right?
No, it is far more insidious. Scopolamine is a powerful anticholinergic drug. It crosses the blood-brain barrier and blocks acetylcholine receptors. In high doses, it can cause unconsciousness or death. But in carefully controlled, lower doses, it induces a state of profound anterograde amnesia and complete submissive behavior.
Submissive behavior meaning like they lose their free will?
Essentially, yes. It suppresses the amygdala, shutting down the brain's ability to process fear or resistance, while simultaneously preventing the brain from forming new memories.
But they aren't unconscious.
No. The victim remains conscious. They can walk, they can talk, their eyes are open, but they become highly suggestible and entirely compliant to commands.
The sources call this the million-dollar ride. It is terrifying to even conceptualize. Phelps could literally walk a drugged, compliant victim down to the lobby, put him in a cab, take him to his bank, and tell him to withdraw his maximum limit.
And no one would know.
Right. To the bank teller, the victim looks perfectly awake and normal. They hand over the cash, and the next day, the victim wakes up in their bed with zero memory of what happened.
Exactly. Phelps used this pharmacological incapacitation to steal iPhones, literally holding the unconscious or compliant victim's face up to the screen to bypass biometric face ID security. She would then drain their bank accounts, transfer their cryptocurrency, and liquidate their retirement funds.
Just emptying their entire lives.
In one documented instance, she kept a victim heavily sedated in his own home for 5 continuous days while she attempted to sell off $3.3 million of his Apple stock.
And she wasn't always successful in keeping them alive either. The indictment links her to at least 3 deaths resulting from massive drug overdoses.
The physical toll is horrifying.
In one horrific detail released by the FBI, she heavily sedated a victim in the United States, strapped him into a wheelchair, and literally pushed him across the U.S.-Mexico border pedestrian crossing.
Just wheeled him right across.
Yes. The border guards just thought she was pushing a sleeping relative. He was found dead in a Mexico City hotel room hours later. It is pure predatory evil.
It represents the complete physical manifestation of the scam logic. Extract the maximum value from the human target with zero regard for their survival.
So we have the industrialized digital ghosts in Southeast Asia, and we have the lethal physical predators like Phelps. But there is also this incredibly bizarre middle ground detailed in our sources, what analysts call luxury and lifestyle fraud.
Right.
I want to transition to the Trajan Nation scam out of Singapore because it so perfectly illustrates how fraudsters can completely bypass our logical defenses in broad daylight.
The Trajan Nation case is fascinating. It involved a young, glamorous married couple in Singapore, Pai Jiping and Siri Wipipansuk. They managed to steal nearly $25 million by setting up a fraudulent pre-order business for ultra-luxury goods, specifically Rolex watches and Hermes handbags.
Now, if I'm going to wire a stranger $100,000 for a Rolex, my guard is going to be incredibly high. I am looking for every single red flag.
Yeah.
But Pai and Pansuk didn't hide behind fake avatars. They used what behavioral scientists call cultural camouflage and overwhelming social proof. They actually met their victims in person at high-end stores on Orchard Road.
And they escalated the intimacy to disarm the victims. They would invite their biggest, most skeptical clients over to their actual home for private dinners. They even introduced victims to Pansuk's elderly grandmother.
Which is brilliant in the most manipulative way possible. I mean, how does meeting a fraudster's grandmother short-circuit our threat detection?
It exploits evolutionary psychology. For millennia, human beings have relied on tribal markers to assess trust. If someone invites you into their inner sanctum, their home, and introduces you to their vulnerable family members, your brain interprets that as the ultimate signal of transparency and mutual vulnerability.
We're wired to trust that.
We are deeply socially conditioned by movies and news to believe that criminals operate in the shadows, wearing masks. When Pai and Pansuk operated in the glaring light of luxury boutiques and family dinners, the victim's brain assumes that such visibility must equal legitimacy. They weaponize the very social norms that are designed to keep us safe.
Which brings us to the most crucial part of this deep dive. If these scammers are this sophisticated, if they can spend 2 years studying your psychology, if they can drug you into submission, if they can use their own grandmother to make you wire the millions of dollars, how does anyone stand a chance?
It's the million-dollar question.
Let's debate the red flags. Using Donna Nelson's story as our anchor, what are the absolute warning signs that our listeners need to be hyper aware of?
This raises an important question about how to spot the illusion early. The first, and arguably the most important red flag in almost all digital relational fraud, is platform migration.
Okay, break that down. What does platform migration look like to the victim?
It happens very early in the interaction. The scammer will make initial contact on a highly populated, reputable platform. Maybe it's a dating app like Tinder or Bartle, or a social network like Facebook or LinkedIn.
Somewhere public.
Right. But almost immediately, usually within the first few messages, they will manufacture an urgent excuse to move the conversation to an encrypted messaging app like WhatsApp, Telegram, or Line.
Let me guess. They do that because if they stay on Tinder, the company can read their messages and catch them.
It's broader than just reading messages. Platforms like Match Group, which owns Tinder or Meta, have highly sophisticated algorithmic security. They are constantly monitoring behavioral patterns, IP addresses, and the velocity of messaging.
So they look for spammy behavior.
Exactly. If an account is suddenly messaging 500 women across the globe with the exact same script, the algorithm flags it and bans the account.
Mm.
By rushing the victim onto an encrypted channel like WhatsApp, the scammer completely isolates the victim from the platform's algorithmic safety nets.
We're off the radar.
Once you are in that encrypted bubble, their communication cannot be monitored, and if you realize it's a scam, law enforcement cannot easily trace the chat logs.
So if your new match immediately says, oh, I don't check this app often, let's move to WhatsApp, that is a massive glowing red flag. What's next?
The refusal of unscripted video contact. As we discussed with the astronaut and the oil rig worker, they will deploy a barrage of excuses to avoid a live FaceTime or Zoom call. If someone claims to be deeply, irrevocably in love with you, but they cannot manage a simple 2-minute video call where their mouth accurately matches the words they are saying, you are dealing with a syndicate.
And we absolutely have to talk about love bombing. This is a term that gets thrown around a lot in pop psychology, but in the context of a scam, it is a highly calibrated weapon.
It is entirely weaponized.
Love bombing is when the person overwhelms you with over-the-top adoration, poetry, and grand declarations of a shared future incredibly early in the relationship. Kelly was telling Donna he wanted to marry her before they ever met.
The mechanism behind love bombing is entirely neurological. When someone showers you with validation and affection, your brain releases massive spikes of dopamine and oxytocin, which are the bonding hormones.
It's a chemical rush.
Over time, your brain becomes addicted to those daily chemical hits. The scammer's goal is to hijack your emotional reasoning. They want you operating out of the amygdala and the limbic system, not the prefrontal cortex where logical analysis takes place. When you are flooded with dopamine, your critical thinking skills literally diminish.
And then there is the first class ticket trap, which we saw play out in Donna's case.
Yes. We are conditioned to look for the ask. We think, as long as they don't ask me for money, I'm safe. But sophisticated operations have R&D budgets. They will spend money on you to cement the illusion.
They invest in the scam.
Whether it's showing you a fake early return on a crypto platform or flying you first class across the world, they use the illusion of wealth to blind you to the underlying risk.
Which leads us directly to the absolute golden rule for our listeners. If you take away nothing else from this deep dive, write this down and remember it forever. Never transport luggage, never receive and reship parcels, and never move money through your bank accounts for someone you have only met in the digital world.
Absolutely never.
No matter how much you believe you love them, no matter how much they have spent on you, just do not do it.
The legal concept of willful blindness will destroy your life. If you act as a money mule for an organized crime syndicate or a drug courier for a cartel, the justice system will not protect you just because you are lonely and manipulated. The physical and legal risk falls 100% on you.
So practically speaking, how do we actively verify who we are talking to? There's a very simple, free tool everyone has access to, the reverse image check. Think of it like running a Carfax report before buying a used car. You wouldn't hand over cash for a vehicle without checking the VIN number to see if it's been in a crash.
It's basic due diligence.
Exactly. If you meet someone online, just take their profile photo, drop it into Google Lens or a site like TinyEye. These engines scour the internet to see where else that specific image exists. You might just find out that the rugged Swedish businessman you've been texting is actually a real estate agent from Chile whose photos were scraped off a public Instagram account.
It is a critical first line of defense. However, I have to provide a very sobering caveat for our listeners regarding the rapidly approaching future. The reverse image search is actively becoming less effective due to the explosion of artificial intelligence.
Because scammers aren't just stealing photos anymore, they are generating them from scratch.
Exactly. We are seeing the rise of phishing as a service networks on the dark web.
Phishing as a service. Explain that phrase, as a service.
Think of how you subscribe to Netflix or a software like Microsoft Word. You pay a monthly fee and they provide the platform and the updates. Criminal developers are doing the exact same thing.
They're selling software subscriptions to other criminals.
Yes. They create highly sophisticated scamming software, including generative AI tools that use JANs or generative adversarial networks. These can instantly create entirely unique, photorealistic human faces that do not exist anywhere else on the internet.
So a reverse image search won't find anything.
It will return zero results because the face was mathematically generated 10 seconds ago.
That is deeply unsettling.
It gets worse. These services now offer real-time deepfake video and voice cloning software. Very soon, the no video call red flag might disappear entirely.
Wait, really? They'll be able to video chat?
Yes. A scammer sitting in a compound in Laos will be able to get on a FaceTime call with you, and the AI filter will perfectly map the fabricated persona onto their face in real time. It will even alter their voice to sound like a native Swedish businessman or an Australian CEO that will be visually and orally indistinguishable from reality.
The ground beneath us is just getting softer and softer. The illusions are becoming perfect. Mm. And that brings us full circle back to Donna Nelson.
It really is a tragic full circle.
Think about the profound tragedy of this situation. Here is a woman whose entire identity was built on serving others. She protected vulnerable children. She fought for her indigenous community. She led health services. She was a beacon of capability. And that beautiful, empathetic life was completely derailed by a single suitcase and a fabricated romance.
Her whole life changed in an instant.
She is sitting in a Japanese detention facility right now. She is halfway across the world from her five daughters, serving a 6-year sentence for a crime she was psychologically, surgically manipulated into committing. It is a profound structural injustice.
It is. And it underscores a vital reality for all of us, which serves as our final call to action today. If you're listening and have a loved one who is isolated, reach out. Isolation is the scammer's greatest weapon.
It really is the vulnerability they exploit the most.
The only way to break the spell of a manufactured digital romance is the tether of genuine real-world connection.
We started this deep dive by comparing a scam to a sinkhole. The foundation erodes invisibly beneath you until everything collapses. When the ground finally collapsed for Donna Nelson, we saw the monster hiding in the dirt, the syndicate known as Kelly. But I want to leave you with a final, highly unsettling thought to explore on your own.
It's a layer to this that most people don't ever consider.
Let's look closer at the people sitting on the other side of those keyboards in Southeast Asia. As recent United Nations reports have revealed, hundreds of thousands of the scammers orchestrating these frauds in those massive compounds are actually victims of human trafficking themselves.
It's a horrific cycle.
They are young people lured by fake advertisements for tech jobs. When they arrive, their passports are confiscated. They are locked behind barbed wire. They are forced to run these romance scams under the explicit threat of severe beatings, electric shocks, and water torture. The person sending you the beautiful poetry, the person manipulating your deep loneliness, might be chained to a desk, terrified for their own life.
Both sides of the screen are trapped.
Exactly. When the person systematically stealing your life savings is a hostage themselves who is the real criminal, and how can global justice possibly solve a crime where both ends of the keyboard are victims? Next time you look down at your phone and see a message from a stranger, remember the invisible, sprawling architecture behind it. The ground beneath our digital lives is hollow. Walk carefully.